This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should love these movies.
We'll decide for ourselves if they're right.
Come and join me, the movie dude Eric.
And me, Kent.
And I, the John Lobster, as we look at classic and independent film.
Welcome to Art House Legends. This episode we're discussing Selma, starring David Oyelowo, Carmen Ejogo, Tom Wilkinson, Oprah Winfrey, Common, Wendell Pierce, Tim Roth, and directed by Ava DuVernay.
This podcast contains spoilers concerning this film. We strongly suggest that you have seen the movie before listening.
There may also be mild to harsh language. Listener discretion is advised.
That said, sit back and enjoy the show.
Gentlemen, it's Oscar season! Woo! Yes, this is my time of year. Oh yeah, I'm happy. I know that some people aren't. We'll talk a little about it, but at this point, I'm just happy we're talking about some Oscar winners. Although this year, or this episode specifically, best original song.
And best original song. We actually have two best original songs this month, which
that's
is
true. Yes, our next
interesting
one is,
for our perspective. But I feel like at least when we're talking about this one, it perhaps might deserve other props, but we'll get to that in a bit.
We'll talk about that because I know that last year, if y'all have been paying attention to our Oscar episodes, I did mention that I did feel that this film did get kind of the shrift in some of the areas because I really enjoyed this film. It didn't make my top 10 list. Came very close. But there's a lot of promise here from a lot of promising talent, and I cannot wait to talk about this movie because there is so much to talk about with some of the stuff that's going on here. So, out of curiosity, did you see this during the Oscar craze last year?
No, I didn't. This was my first time checking out this film. And I got the DVD from the public library and watched it. And I was kind of sad that I hadn't chosen to see it sooner.
What about you, Kent?
This was my first time seeing it. Watched it yesterday and watched it again today. On Hulu, actually. Yeah. I was kind of surprised to see it there. But
well, it was on Hulu. It was on Amazon. It wasn't on Netflix. Apparently, the Epix deal ran out, so a lot of the Paramount stuff is gone. But it's all on Amazon, so it's still there. I'm going to say that when the first moment I saw the trailer for Selma, I was hooked. First off, I'm very intrigued by the life and times of Martin Luther King Jr., especially a film that is dealing with a specific area of his life. Another one of my one of my favorite films that I've seen regarding Martin Luther King Jr. is a movie called Boycott that had Jeffrey Wright playing Martin Luther King during the Birmingham bus strikes, which is really good. If you haven't seen it, I strongly recommend that movie. This one, I was curious because I don't know about you, but I have actually been paying attention to David Oyelowo for about a couple of years now. I think that he's one of those that guy who is in that thing. Although a lot of his things were a lot of geeky things because he has quite a bit of a geek sheet on him. I mean, I know that the big one that most people go straight to is that he was a heavy part of Dread that came out the year prior to this. But have y'all noticed or did y'all know about David Oyelowo before seeing this movie? Could you pronounce his name before seeing this movie?
I can make an attempt at pronouncing his name prior to this.
I had to learn. It took me like 2 months to learn how to say his name. And I'm not kidding here. Brad Pitt actually had to teach me how to say his name because he had to pronounce it very slowly for the press. I believe it was during one of the award ceremonies last year that he just got tired of people butchering his name. So he made sure that everyone knew how to say it. So I've gotten to the point where I can actually say it five times fast. which I won't do. I won't do. Maybe on the at the end of the episode, I might give it a shot. But there. All right. So the other big one coming in here is the filmmaker who's doing this now. Ava DuVernay is our director, but interesting enough, our producer here is none other than Oprah Winfrey.
Oh yeah.
Now, the interesting thing here is that Oprah was also part of another movie, I believe, that came out maybe not that year, but the year before, that was definitely trying to go for Oscar, which was Lee Daniels' The Butler, which I absolutely hated.
Well, that do you know the story behind that, though?
Go ahead, tell me.
Lee Daniels was attached to direct this.
Yes, he was.
And he, based on scheduling and everything, kind of had to make a choice between which film he wanted to do. And he went with The Butler, and they gave this to Ava DuVernay to film. And I guess Oprah had been involved with funding and producing both with her Harpo Studios label. Mm-hmm. And so she got to be in both. I think she had a larger role in The Butler.
She did, a vastly larger role.
And I want to say that David Oyelowo also appears in The Butler as well.
If I'm not correct, he played the Butler's son.
The son, right. That's what I was thinking, yeah. So, and again, both films deal with civil rights and also presidents, which is interesting, mm-hmm. and relationships with presidents. But I saw The Butler actually in the theater. My parents really wanted to see it, so we went and saw The Butler. And it was, you're right, kind of dreadful.
I mean, this was like, you understand, I was excited about The Butler. I was like, because I love movies about seeing behind the scenes, especially when it comes to like the White House and, you know, seeing the perspective of a butler. And my God, that movie was awful. It was dreadful. You know, when you say that he left it, I was hoping it had something to do with a boo-boo kitty that has now become a mainstay in television, which I'm eventually going to have to get around to at some point. But Ava DuVernay, who, believe it or not, I actually knew who she was before this movie came out. She had actually done a small film that, for the life of me, is actually like, I've seen the movie. It was about a woman and her mother. It was a small indie film, and it was incredible. It was an incredible debut. And when I saw that she was doing this, this is on par with like Rian Johnson going from Brick straight to like Star Wars. This is, you know, to have something that big and something where there's going to be a lot of attention, because there's very few films that are able to be made about Martin Luther King Jr. because the estate is extremely picky about the projects that are made about Martin Luther King Jr. And I have to admit that if it didn't have the name Oprah on there, this movie would have never been made. And I guess I'm going to show my hand a little bit here. I'm very glad that it did, because my expectations were gloriously met when I saw it in theaters. Whether it holds up now, we're going to get into. Now that there's been a year to kind of chew and mull it over, I'm excited to talk about this film and what I see it now. But yeah, let's go ahead and let's get into this, because this film is quite unique. Now, this is definitely this because of the title, we're dealing with the events of Selma, Alabama, which happened in 1964, if I'm not correct. And this is coming on the heels of Martin Luther King Jr.'s Nobel Peace Prize win, and what was supposed to be a slam dunk win with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, if I'm going to correct.
Right.
Yeah. And so I have to admit here that this time around, one thing that I really appreciated was just how much they were able to tell the historical elements with shorthand. When we see Lyndon Johnson talking about events, he's giving us the background with the what he's done, the events that have led up to this point. Whenever King is talking about the events that happened in both Athens, Georgia, I forgot where it was. The where he had the missteps.
Talk about Albany.
Yeah. Albany, yes, Albany. Sorry. For some reason, I thought it was Athens. Sorry, but Albany, as well as what happened in Montgomery. A lot of stuff is being told. We get the politics behind what is going on with the civil rights movement, right? Because
sure,
it isn't just one movement here. That's one thing. No,
absolutely not. And it's not just one philosophy either, which you get a sense of in this film.
That's true. So, and they did a really good job of being able to tell this stuff in shorthand without feeling like they have to preach it to the audience. They're not trying to do a history lesson. They're trying to get a snapshot. And I guess the question is, what did you think of the snapshot and the way that it kind of has this fly on the wall mentality, not trying to go for big grandiose moments, but more interested in silent, quiet moments. Even the first time we see Martin Luther King, you know, it's a quiet moment, you know, with him trying to fix an ascot for his Nobel Peace Prize, and the moments that he has with Coretta Scott. What did you take of all this?
Well, it's certainly an interesting approach to the biopic, because we've seen, even just biopic type films that we've discussed on this podcast, we've seen different approaches to how you tell those stories. And so when it comes to an individual that I think today would certainly be considered larger than life, and in fact, kind of in the civil parlance is kind of a saint of American history, right? Like you look at Martin Luther King, like we get a day off from school, a national holiday to celebrate his life and accomplishments.
Well, I mean, let's be honest here. When it comes to historical figures in U.S. history, Martin Luther King is one that so far has really been kind of lionized, because even with like the likes of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, and even the likes of Malcolm X or any other historical figure, were able to kind of discuss their faults. With Martin Luther King Jr., who had major faults, they're not as
pronounced.
Right, that's true. Right. And so to take the approach which this film does of showing, like you said, showing the quieter moments, the lighter moments, certainly the self-doubt and the not confliction about what it is that he's doing, but certainly the confliction of, or the conflict between what he's doing and his own personal life.
Yeah.
And you get more, I think, a deeper portrait from this film than you would perhaps some, or that you would from kind of different approaches to it. And you mentioned kind of the fly on the wall perspective. Quite literally, a lot of the film is told through what we assume to be bugs, which would be the FBI under the auspices of J. Edgar Hoover spying on King to see what he's up to and what his movement is up to as well.
Well, I don't think that it's telling the story through the bugs. What I think it is that it's a way for us to jump from story to story and have these kind of ties that doesn't feel arbitrary. Because we are kind of taking the events, it's a juxtaposition from the events that we're seeing to the events that the FBI are recording. Which I think is a pretty awesome way of having that juxtaposition to give us a sense that, yes, King was under extreme scrutiny from every place he got. But what about you, Kent? What did you take from all this?
Just from the small moment thing that was still
on?
Yeah, the final wall. That seems to be where most stuff really happens. Small, just a couple people in a room deciding what's happening, not the big motion that comes later, but the decision on how to do it. Mm-hmm. And the warnings back and forth where it's like, no, let's not do it this way, let's do it this way, and the arguments thereof. And Of course, unfortunately, we know about all these things because the FBI was bugging everything. So
here's an interesting thing that I thought was interesting or that really kind of caught me this time around on this watching. This movie has a lot of shadows. The first time we meet most of the characters, they're in shadow, with the exception of, I think, if I'm not correct, we didn't have a shadow when we were introduced to Lyndon Johnson, but everyone is kind of in shadows. And what's interesting is that usually sometime at the beginning of when we are introduced to these characters, they usually find themselves being cast into light. With King, we go from the shadows of the ready room where he's getting his ascots ready, and he's thrust right into the lights of the Oslo ceremony, the Nobel ceremony. Almost all the characters come from shadow into the light. And even with what King says, he in several places he talks about that he's not that he wants to take the things out of the shadows and bring it to the light. So I found it very interesting that the film played with shadows as much as it does, and that when and that especially when King is at his most contemplative, when he is dealing with his with most of his most difficult decisions, or he's feeling the weight of those decisions, it's usually in darkness. It's usually in very dim light. And I found that quite interesting that light and shadow played such a large part in how this film presents itself. But did y'all notice this, or did y'all notice any other motifs that kind of go along with what the story is trying to tell?
Oh. I noticed most of the time where... Except for when if people were breaking the law and trying not to get caught, it was mostly in shadow. Like all the beatings outside, except for when cameras are present and it's
well, it's interesting broad you daylight. Say that.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that I found interesting is when the major attack on the bridge happens, they bring out the smoke canisters, which was meant not to – it wasn't like tear gas in the sense of dispersing. It was meant to distort the cameras from seeing visibly what was going on.
See, I wasn't sure about that at the time because I thought it was tear gas until – because I figured that's why the gas masks were on the hover cut on the first.
Well, I guess you're
right. It is just to drop out the cameras so news crews can't see.
I thought that was quite interesting that they played with visibility. Maybe it isn't just shadow, it's visibility, being able to see clearly what's going on. What about you, Lobster? What did you take of all this?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the film and from the director and the cinematographer has a unique visual style, I think, that kind of fits the subject matter. And I really kind of enjoyed following the camera and seeing how the camera approaches the different scenes and the different things. A lot of times what's important might be what's in the background in a given shot, which is kind of fun. Mm-hmm. And it certainly does for a film that's dealing with very much real world places. And I think the most iconic being the Edmund Pettus Bridge. It incorporates the scope of those physical places and uses them, I think, to pretty good effect.
Yeah. So I guess what we should talk about, because this really is about people. Another thing that I really appreciate about what this film does is it isn't about events as much as people, how they interpret those events, what they thought about those events. Even with the likes of Lyndon Baines Johnson, we're interested in how he perceives these events in comparison to all the other things that he's doing. This is a pretty even-handed movie in with all the characters, even to the likes of George Wallace, where, you know, we don't agree with them. But the film is very fair as to his take on it, and I got to give it to Tim Roth. His performance as George Wallace is pretty astounding, considering that he could have easily just gone over the top, played to the ham. George Wallace is definitely one of those characters that it almost begs to overplay it. Hell, we have Lyndon Baines Johnson, easily one of the most flamboyant presidents we've ever had. And you got to give it to Tom Wilkinson that he refused to go over the top.
Yeah, it's interesting. Certainly the casting choices in these, you have predominantly British actors playing some of these iconic roles, and certainly a lot of Brits playing Southerners, which I found interesting. When you have Tom Wilkinson, who's British, when you have Tim Roth and David.
David Oyelowo and Carmen Gojo are all they're both Nigerian Brits.
Yeah. But to me, it's interesting to have so many British actors kind of playing these Southern roles, and of course then you're having the accents involved in that too. Can we talk, I think, for a minute about the diction in the movie? This movie surprised me in kind of the unique, and I thought very special, attention it paid to the way the actors pronounce their words.
Okay, as the Southerner of the group, I've got to say something that's really impressive for me to say. I didn't even notice, because that's what I hear all the time. It was so normal. Again, they could have easily drawn it out and really played up the Southern, especially when you hear the Martin Luther King Jr. speak in public. You know, he has a very unique style. I love how David Oyelowo finds this way of kind of giving it the gravitas, but you don't expect him to talk in platitudes in, you know, with an inner group, but you still get the sense of how he would talk to his inside crowd. And I didn't even realize it. I'm pretty keen on languages and, yeah, and accents, and it sounded natural.
This was believable for you?
I mean, I don't know if how Brits felt about Renee Zellweger playing Bridget Jones, but for me,
yeah,
this was it's embarrassing that I think the only other actor who could have pulled off as an amazing an accent would have been Matthew McConaughey. But then again, that's where he come from.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's kind of the key point that I was trying to make, is that they didn't cast necessarily iconic Southern actors to play some of these roles. When you think about some of the actors working in Hollywood that have, you know, that their kind of bread and butter is playing those types of characters, and certainly you can think of a few that could have played Wallace or Johnson or and fit in those roles pretty well. But they went with kind of, at least for some of the main actors, some sort of classically trained British actors that are accustomed to, one would imagine, trying out different accents, because for the range of accents that we have here in the States, there's an even broader range in a much smaller geographic area in England, in the United Kingdom. So to me, that kind of impressed me. So I really enjoyed watching the film and just kind of listening to everyone talk. Mm-hmm. And kind of the way that language gets used, which, again, if you're dealing with a lead character who is probably one of the greatest speech givers of the 20th century, mm-hmm, then you kind of have to pay very close attention to how he talks.
Well, that's true, but what I found very interesting here is, with the exception of the speech that he gives at the courthouse at the end of the film, he doesn't give speeches.
Church he does.
Well, do you know why, though? Because they're licensed to another movie studio that's developing a film. And so somehow, and I don't know exactly how this works, but his, like, the King family estate that kind of like license out the use of those, license them, I think, to Warner Brothers to develop a project there. So they had to rewrite, I guess, some of the speeches at least enough that they were separate and legally distinct.
Perhaps, but I think that with that hindrance actually came a strength in the film, which is that this isn't about platitudes. This isn't about sweeping epic oration. This is about the inner workings of Martin Luther King and his crew as they're trying to take on one of the most difficult and the most challenging portions of the civil rights movement.
Otherwise, it would be called King's Speech, right?
Well, kind of.
See what I did there?
King's Speech.
Yeah, we're trying to ignore it.
All right, fair enough. Yeah. It's not often that I can work in a pun about the movie title itself that works so well. But you're right. Again, so it's not about giving a speech. It's about overcoming the stuff inside to...
Well, I mean, one of the things I really appreciate is especially how so there's really two storylines that I think, or I'm gonna say three, but the two that were really prevalent to me in the on this particular viewing that I really appreciated. The first one is that we're kind of getting the last temptation of Martin Luther King. He is at a low point. You know, he's getting resistance from his political allies. He is facing possibly one of the most difficult challenges in facing down not just Jim Clark, the sheriff, but again, the extremely flamboyant and widely liked governor of Alabama, or liked in the state at least.
Yeah.
I love the fact that they explain exactly why Selma matters with in regards to voting rights and making sure that African American voters are capable of or African Americans can get the ability to vote because by making Jim Clark a central figure in the film, it keeps reminding us what it is that they're fighting against. Because this guy shouldn't even, in my opinion, he shouldn't even be responsible for protecting a donut shop, much less a city like Selma.
Considering Basil, we can call him Basil, right?
I wouldn't want to give Basil that kind of esteem, to be honest. But the thing is that especially when it comes to Selma specifically, I love the fact that there are several scenes that really play it up. What I'll call the Oprah scene, which is this well-known figure that was kind of the, I don't want to call her the Rosa Parks of Selma, but she it was her fight and struggle that kind of gave a face to what was happening in Selma. I'm trying to remember her name. I think it was...
You mean Annie Lee Cooper?
Oh, Annie Lee Cooper, yeah.
Yeah.
She became kind of the face of what was going on in Selma.
Right.
And, yeah, when you know, you see this, I mean, again, I think we had this conversation, I forgot where it was, where, you know, it's one thing to have history be told to you. It's another thing to kind of see it in action.
Well, and immediately thereafter... Or is it just before? I'm mixing up the scenes, but you see the bombing of the church in Birmingham, Alabama.
Yeah, that happened before Annie Lee Cooper. In fact, if I'm not correct, it goes from the bombing straight to Annie Lee Cooper.
So then that sets up the scene where King meets with Johnson and says, look, here's what we need to have happen, and this is why. And he lays out the case of why voting rights are so important and why it's an issue that can't wait. But Johnson says, nah, it can wait.
Well, another thing that I like about this is that, again, it also allows Johnson to defend himself, which is, you have one problem, I have 99. While without having to actually go into a whole lot of detail, the film makes it very clear. Johnson's trying to fight this fight. He is trying to fight it. The problem is that he's also having to do a billion other things, not to mention this little thing in Vietnam that's going on. And they don't ignore it. They don't ignore those things. The only thing that they ignore, which pisses me off, is the fact that Johnson is as corrupt a politician as ever. They do kind of give him a little bit more dignity than I think possibly is deserving. But at the same time, in regards to the civil rights movement, he definitely moved the ball further along than any other politician prior to him. And you can't say that he didn't use a bulk of his political clout in order to get the civil rights acts out there the way.
Well, he used
did.
A lot of Kennedy's clout, I think.
Right.
And then capitalized on that.
No, because Kennedy didn't make a whole lot of inroads in civil rights. That was never a priority.
Well, it wasn't the Kennedy clout. It was the, Kennedy's dead.
Right. And in his honor, in his legacy, we need to make this thing happen.
Well, yeah. I would say when it comes to the initial Civil Rights Act and the one that is made out here, then yes, it would probably be the clout of the Kennedy, the later one.
And right after that, he gets elected or reelected by a pretty good margin.
But the second story that I was really appreciating, and I didn't really give it as much attention the first time I saw the film, is Coretta Scott King's struggle in all this. This film, I didn't realize the first time I saw it just how much time and attention was given to her and what she's having to go through, not just in the struggles that she has being, you know, having her family constantly under the threat of violence and death almost the entire time through the film, to the point where anytime that she's not with her kids, part of you just kind of like, what's happening to the kids? Where are the kids? Yeah. Are they okay? Because you hear the calls, you see what it's doing to her, and on top of that, to know that her husband, the one that she's been supporting and has been like advocating like crazy, has had affairs that she's known about, and that she's been kind of, I don't want to say turn a blind eye, but definitely kind of compartmentalized in that great scene. And I have to say, one of the great scenes of the film is when the FBI does send the audio tape, and we see that struggle and the power between Carmen Ogojo and David Oyelowo as performers. Is astronomical. The way that they played this scene, the heartache, the frustration, the pause between when she calls him out and when he finally admits it, the pacing. I was just impressed with just this entire scene and how it played out, because it could have easily turned into a scene of, just kind of, aha, he had affairs. It was personal. The way that she tied it to her struggle of, you know, every time I don't know when everything could be taken away from me, you know, when everyone could be killed, you know, because of this. And we ask ourselves, or at least I asked myself this time, is this too much? Is this too much to ask of anybody? What kind of sacrifice did she give in all of this? But what were your takes on Coretta? What did you make of her character and how Carmen Ogojo played her?
Well, I have to say it's great casting. And you mentioned that she's played this role a couple of times.
Yes.
Before. But I thought, again, there was great chemistry there and really, really great acting and reacting from both of them in the scenes that they had together. And you also kind of get an appreciation for the role that Coretta Scott King played as a go-between, both between the various branches of the civil rights movement that you find out are kind of or sometimes running counter to each other, despite the fact that they are working for the same cause. They differ in their methodology, and you get a sense of that between King and Malcolm X as well in the scene that you kind of have worked in there.
Okay, I've got a little confession to make. Uh-oh. I recently saw Malcolm X, and seeing someone that we might be talking about later on this month play Malcolm X, and just how fervent and fiery Denzel Washington was, and to see this portrayal of Malcolm X as kind of at the end, just before his assassination. Which I'm glad that we didn't get, because we've seen it several times in other movies, and I don't think it needed to be in this movie. But just to know that, you know, this is a guy that was willing to play he was basically playing the bad wrestler, and this was like, you know, either you go with King or you go with me, ha 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 ha, kind of thing, right? I mean, that was what he was offering, right?
Yeah, which kind of works in that real situation. It's like he's offering peace and
non-violence. Non-violence versus the opposite of non-violence, which you don't, you know, he doesn't even have to say.
This is
I think it is interesting when you have Martin Luther King Jr. talking about the battle zone and the need for drama and setting the stage. I thought that was all really interesting as well. That's kind of like the big takeaway from me from this film was seeing the inner workings in the leadership and certainly the friction between the various factions.
That was another aspect of it I really appreciate. I love seeing the inner workings of these different groups. It's one of those things where it's so easy to think that there was only one group that was dealing with this, but in fact, it's like groups within groups that were working with groups. Like you have the local group that was doing the groundwork even before King came to Selma. You have the student groups that had built these networks, and basically they were just giving it over to King for him to get all the glory while they sat on the kind of played lapdog to him. And you can understand why they'd get mad at,
yep,
you know, at having all this work so that someone else can come in and just, you know, wow and awe. And I thought it was kind of interesting that they played up John Lewis specifically as a massive part of this story. I don't know if y'all are familiar with John Lewis. He is a long-running, I believe, senator of Georgia.
Congressman.
Yeah. So, yes, we are familiar.
Yeah.
We both know more than that.
Well, you know, I'm just saying very few people
sure.
Pay attention to these types of things. John Lewis, who isn't exactly the cleanest of politicians either, but... again, it's just kind of interesting how he's become the focal point of the locals, right? Considering that technically speaking, I think he wasn't even a local. I think he was a Georgian who came to help out.
Right. But I mean, the implication is that SNCC has been on the ground there for 2 years and has kind of done the organizing and done the legwork to set the stage for everything and get everyone organized and communicated and all of that. Mm-hmm. And King and his group, SCLC, would come in and then kind of stir everything up and make everything into, it's kind of like SNCC has been, you know, they saw the hornet's nest and they said, okay, we're gonna plan a map and to get us kind of around the hornet's nest to where we want to go. And King says, no, we're going to kick the hornet's nest and we're going to get stung, but that's going to get it on the news.
Well, I think that's part of it. I think another thing, one of the great scenes when it comes to John Lewis and the actor who played John Lewis in this film is in the way that he kind of lays it out is like, look, if we keep doing what we're doing, yeah, we'll keep the fight, you know, we'll keep fighting the good fight, but nothing will get changed. The only way that there's going to be change is through King. King is the one who's bringing the cameras. King is the one that is the lightning rod. He, you know, is going to be what he does and what he, his celebrity that is going to fire things off. And in what he's asking, and I love the fact that that King actually asks, which is, look, you're going to have to let me do this. And they have a hard time letting go, and you can understand why. The even-handedness in how this film deals with with everybody, again, it just really surprises me how everyone seems to have, you know, a voice, with the exception, I think, which is interesting, Jim Clark is the only one that doesn't have a second side. We never get a moment with him where he's laying out his ideas. He's the boogeyman. He's the villain. George Wallace isn't even the villain in this one.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's kind of a puppet man, not even a puppet master. He doesn't stop anyone, or he can't even stop Jim Clark, which I thought was interesting. The film makes
Johnson,
it very clear.
Johnson just flat out tells him, we know you don't run the state. It's all those individuals in the individual counties running it.
Well, no, it's Stephen Root. Yeah. Stephen Root lays it out for him that, you know, Jesus Christ and George Washington.
He's still looking for his stapler.
Elvis Presley. Yeah.
It's just interesting. It's like Stephen Root just I think that there needs to be like a drinking game with Stephen Root at this
yes,
point.
Yes, I am a fan of that drinking game because I always raise my glass or my piece of cake, which I did not receive at the television whenever I see him come on screen.
Yes, but I love how there's so much attention to detail that they are giving exposition, but they're finding ways of doing it through these dialogues without it coming off as exposition. It feels like a conversation that you would actually have. When it comes to the issue of Jim Clark, Wallace knows that Clark is going to be the one on trial, but what Clark does is going to affect whatever they do, in Alabama. And it's funny. It's like because it's like he sees the train coming, he can't stop it. And I love the fact that you can almost even like the final scene of him, hiding in the governor's office, watching outside. It's like he can't stop it. As much as he wants to, as much as he is fighting for what he believes, he can't stop it because it's out of his hands. And I thought that was kind of interesting how the film starts with that and it ends with that. But what did you take of our villain here or our villains? Where do you find empathy for them? Do you find yourself hating them more often, or are they more or do you find me like how I feel about Mr. Potter?
I think in terms of films that deal with this topic, and again, these are historical figures and they're individuals whose lives have been studied before. And so you can kind of do your own homework and make your own decision. But in a film like this, which is about a struggle against oppression, everyone kind of has to take on a different facet of the oppressor. So you have the like literal, we will beat you over the head to keep you down and make you stay down oppressor, and that's the sheriff. You have sort of the mid-level bureaucrat who benefits from the status quo being kept because that keeps him in office. So you have Stephen Root there. You have kind of the upper level local governor of the state that has been elected under Jim Crow, under restricted voting, and now is not only facing the specter that he's going to lose that white majority that has kept him in office, but also if he doesn't take a firm stance now, then the whites that voted for him aren't going to vote for him again either. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have all that. And then at the highest level of power, you have someone like Lyndon Johnson, who, while yes, he does feel sympathetic and isn't it tragic, he is content to try to placate King with a cabinet position and say, we can do so much good, we just kind of have to put this on the back burner at this time. So you kind of have a lot of different villains with a lot of different motivations, but at the end of the day, they're all interested in keeping the status quo of oppression the way it is and not allowing any more change to occur than has already been threatened.
Yeah.
What do you think, Kent?
I almost see the villain as the entire society that would do this to another segment of society. Yeah. Like from in this huge, I almost want to say super organism phase, but it's like this entire system that's looking at just from the littlest, from that register at the beginning going, oh, I'm going to deny because
right.
I feel like
yep.
it,
yep.
all the way up is just, oh, and also to the thugs that just decide, yeah, we're going to kill this guy over here because he supports King.
Right.
It feels to me almost worse than any individual person because it's a whole thought process
the entire
that you can't
system.
Get rid of.
Exactly. The entire system, the entire society is set up so that really the game is rigged.
Right.
And you don't have a fair shot based on the color of your skin. And I mean, like, academically, we know that when we look at this period, right? But it's seeing the reality of it portrayed that you go, yeah, that's not cool.
Just get uneasy thinking, this is what some people call the good old days. And like, no, that doesn't
make America great again.
I didn't want to go there, but yes.
and I think before we do, before we do close out our discussion, we're going to talk about.
There's a lot of political.
Talk about kind of the current political climate and kind of the current state of race relations, which the Oscar winning song from this film takes on directly. And I think probably won the Oscar, not because it relates to Selma, but because it relates to Ferguson.
Yes and no. But one thing that I find very interesting when you look at both how the film portrays Selma, and I feel that it is time. I don't think that the film intended to embody the current political issue regarding race relations. I think it definitely came out at a time when we needed a kind of a reminder of what systematic oppression can look like. That said, the thing is one thing, or I guess for me, what really impressed me with the song specifically as the film is that it's not about one group overcoming everything against them. It's about bringing everybody together to fight it together, to we're all in this together situation. Like when King calls for the clergy to come, that he intended to strike the conscience of not African Americans but of white Americans. He wanted white Americans to see what's happening and for them to demand change to occur, which is something that you could say was what individuals in the Black Lives Matter the movement was trying to do when it came to Ferguson as well, is to raise that consciousness not to the crowd but to those outside the crowd, to hit people from not just the United States but also from the rest of the world. It was meant to create awareness, right, and to create conscience of regards to this issue. And we've seen what in both Selma and with the Black Lives Matter as well, is that created a scrutiny towards the system. There became scrutiny towards the oppressors for the most part. Now, you could say in both cases that there was still a long way to go, that we're talking about small band-aids to a larger problem. But that consciousness, and I think Glory specifically, and I feel like we should be talking about Common quite a bit here. I feel like Common, if I'm not correct, I know that he and John Legend both wrote the song, but I got the sense, maybe it's just because I am familiar with Common's work specifically, and this feels more like Common than John Legend.
Sure. John Legend sings the hook.
Well, he sings the hook, but
it's Common that raps out the song, which is really well written, and I love a lot of the little turns of phrase in it.
Well, it's not just that, but he's also an actor in the film. He actually plays a large part in the film. Well, it's not that he appears; he actually has a large part. But just like with the song, it's all meant to complement the overall. He doesn't have a big scene. He doesn't have a speech. All of his stuff is in the background, but he fits there. And this isn't the first time that I've seen Common in films. And he's actually an incredibly well gifted actor that I think deserves a little bit more work in that aspect if he wants it. I don't know if he aspires to acting or if he prefers the music gig. He's well suited for both.
You can see him in a bunch of stuff.
He has a lot of stuff coming out this year.
He's been acting for a while. A film like this that we might someday discuss might be like American Gangster. He was in And he's going to show up, it looks like, in Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
Yes. And John Wick 2 coming up, which is...
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about Keanu. Maybe that's John Wick 2.5 or something.
Right. And he's a series regular on Hell on Wheels, which is a pretty cool show.
Yes, one that I've seen him on as well. But actually, the movie I saw him in that really impressed me was he did a romantic comedy with Queen Latifah. Forgot the name of it. But it's really good, especially for romantic comedy. He plays a basketball star that falls in love with someone that's helping him rehabilitate. I forgot.
Uh-huh.
Again, it's annoying me. I don't have the name of it. I'll figure it out someday. But no, it's really good though. And Common was really, really good in that movie.
But yeah, the song. So Glory, yes. Right? And
the
again,
only thing. The only thing it won an Academy Award for was the song, which kind of surprised me.
It was nominated for Best Picture, and Ava DuVernay was nominated as well. Or no, she wasn't.
No, she wasn't.
Which I was a little disappointed in,
yeah.
Specifically because I mean, it wasn't the best direction in the world, but it's promising in a sense and we'll talk about her in a minute because I do feel like we need to talk about Glory before we move into her direction.
Yeah, let's break down the song a little bit. Do you guys? I pulled up the lyrics. With rap especially. It's great to listen to. I'm a huge fan of rap music, but I love to actually read the lyrics and kind of deconstruct them a little bit because you get what I find takes me maybe 10 times listening to the song to actually pick out. When I look at the lyrics, I'm like, oh yeah, that's good.
I'm not a fan of rap music specifically, although let me put it this way. It's not that I don't like rap music, is that I am very particular in the kind of rap music that I get into. I will say that the thing that caught me with this is John Legend, because I am a John Legend fan. And what Common and John Legend did here is pretty amazing. It's definitely, in my opinion, it's probably one of the best Oscar-winning songs in quite a while, and some of them are not that good. In fact, I don't understand how some of them just get nominated.
A lot of them, it seems, maybe might have been in an animated movie or two.
Some of them,
just
although...
let it go.
I'm sorry, I can't let it go. No, definitely.
Yeah.
But I think these are kind of the best of the Oscar-winning songs. So Oscar-winning songs that are from a film that might be a historical film like Selma, but you can take that song, and obviously the song comes from the consciousness of an actor living or a singer, a writer living today, and you can then take that song and it stands a little timeless. So you can apply it to Selma, you can apply it to Ferguson or Baltimore or wherever, and it still holds resonance, which I think is really good. And I think that's why this is probably one of the better of the Oscar winning songs in recent years, I think, including the one that we're going to talk about next week.
Yes.
From Once.
But I will say, before we get off of this, did y'all see the performance at the Oscars? Because
yes. Yeah. That was fantastic. Yeah.
That was.
And that right there, you feel why it won when you see it performed. Yeah. And that's I always look forward to that during the Oscars when they perform all of the songs, because I get a really clear sense when and don't get me wrong, like the performance of Everything is Awesome was great. That was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
But it did not have the same impact of them performing Glory.
Yeah. Although, to be fair, it wasn't no any it's hard out there for a pimp, just saying.
So one of the turns of phrase, just before we get off the song, I want to pick out a couple lines especially that I think are really good. And the first line that Common says I really enjoy, which is "Hands to the heavens, no man, no weapon," which I think is so, that's such a good message to kind of start the song with. And again, you can totally apply it to Martin Luther King.
Well,
or
that's his thing. Yeah.
It's just another way of saying "hands up, don't shoot," which I think is fantastic to kind of like to kind of draw that parallel between the two, the struggles. And it kind of goes on through that, through the first verse. And one thing that I really like as well is, justice for all just ain't specific enough, which is another kind of like direct call out to Black Lives Matter, because kind of the popular, response, I think, from
is all lives matter.
Yeah. Right. And that kind of, yeah, you're okay, but now you're missing the point, right? Like, yeah. Yes, all lives matter, but specifically here are lives that are being devalued. And so, you kind of have to be more specific when you say justice for all, sure. But you have to kind of acknowledge where that's not quite being the case. So I think that's really good. And it kind of goes on, through that, which I think is really good. And the second verse, it kind of goes through kind of a broader message of what Selma means today, which I think is really good. And there's some really good wordplay. And one of them that I really like is, saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald eagle. The biggest weapon is to stay peaceful. Yeah. I think that was
definitely one of the lyrics that I've really impressed me in regards to the song itself. There are a few others. I'm drawing a blank, but yeah, it's just that, when it comes to how this the song kind of both attributes both today's issues along, or I don't want to say it's today's issues, but you know, of the period, because by the time that we actually, as we go further, this is going to kind of date the film, but in a way it's dating it on a good level. This is giving us an impression of the events of Selma, while at the same time it's giving us an impression on the events of 2014-2015, specifically. I feel like 5 years from now, we're going to be able to get a gauge of how this film is relevant to that particular period, as well as to the period that it was created. And a lot of films, either they try to play it too much to allegory, or they try to do too much to just specifically its own time period. That this, I think, finds that perfect balance of giving us kind of an impression of Selma while not feeling like it's a slave to the event specifically of Selma, that it is telling us something
right.
of 2014-2015.
And I think this is kind of a good time to segue into how Ava DuVernay approaches the material, because there are some creative license taken with events and with the way that things unfolded, which while in terms of the film aren't necessarily exactly as things unfolded. Mm-hmm. And again, this is a period that not only was the nation paying attention to then, but has been studied quite thoroughly by historians since. But I think the changes to the timeline that the director makes sense in terms of telling the story, because for instance, I think one of the things that I'll kind of like pick out is when you have the shooting of Jimmie Lee Jackson in the restaurant there after the night march, that's one of the most powerful scenes in the film, and it didn't quite unfold that way. He wasn't gunned down in the front of the restaurant, and he didn't die at the scene. Mm-hmm. But he died. I think he was in the hospital and died like 8 days later. But then you wouldn't get that impact, I don't think, on the screen as much if they kind of drug it out a bit. Which again, while yeah, it, okay, so maybe that would heighten tension or something like that. But to just have that finality of it in the moment makes, I think, a bigger impact on screen.
I agree. I also think that in these particular cases, the film is trying to give us kind of, I don't want to say a romantic look, because obviously there's nothing romantic about this film, especially even in the portrayal of Martin Luther King Jr. This is a film that wants to show the world coming down on his shoulders. Part of me wants to talk about The Last Temptation of Christ in this, because I feel like both films are doing the same thing, where you're seeing a widely renowned person having all of just the amount of history just crushing them, just seeing the weight of the expectation put upon them, literally breaking them to their, you know, to the point where you can understand if they just said screw this, I'm done. You could see it in both instances. And to see them make the choice to keep going and to stay the course, even though there's no guarantee that this is going to work. There's no guarantee that anything is going to be changed by the sacrifices being made. And even in the sense of this film, I think that Selma, historically speaking, because I also believe some of the events in regards to the priest that gets killed was also kind of embellished a little bit, if I'm not correct. But the thing is that it's trying to get, I think, 3 points across that's spanning the timelines between events of Selma and events of today, which is that there is a systematic oppression that's happening in both instances, that there are those that are trying to raise awareness and to combat it through peaceful means, even though there are some that are just getting sick and tired of waiting and are pushing, even though it is causing more trouble than helping, and that there are those that are willing to sacrifice themselves that probably it would outside of the conscience, there is no reason for them to get involved. When that priest dies, again, he's dying because he believes in the cause of King, right? He wants fairness, but he's not going to get anything out of this other than his conscience or his clear conscience, right? And on top of that, he isn't even going to get a free bus ticket, basically just taking a prayer on the Pettus Bridge. And I want to talk about how DuVernay gets these points across specifically, because she, and if you've seen her other film, and I strongly recommend if you've, I'm really pissed off I don't remember the name of the film. And this is one of those days I'm just really off my game, I can't help. But anyway, DuVernay is more interested in how people relate with one another, how they communicate with one another, how they get their points across with one another, and the divides between people. That is something that excites me about her as a filmmaker. In my opinion, I feel like if given enough opportunities, and I'm hoping that Selma opens more doors for her than ever before, and I am kind of glad that she didn't take the easy one, which would have been to do a Marvel movie. I can only imagine what is possible with her as a filmmaker. Part of me wishes that, in a way, we could have talked about Do the Right Thing if it were nominated for film or if it won Oscars. Because I feel like this is, in a way, Ava DuVernay's response to Do the Right Thing of her period. And it's not as militant, it's not as angry as Do the Right Thing. But I think you can see the frustration. You can see the anger. You can see people trying to fight, a fight that is overwhelming, just at its core. And she's up to that task. She did a great job in conveying that. She did a great job of humanizing Martin Luther King and not making him this saint. She did a great job of creating an atmosphere that feels both relevant to his time and relevant to today, which is a lot harder than people understand. It's really hard to be able to bridge those gaps. And she did a great job, and she got an impressive cast. I mean, we talked about just a handful. This thing has got more actors in it of renown than, I would say, like a billion Butlers.
Sure.
I mean, we got Niecy Nash.
The Butler tried to pack him in, too, but, I mean, you've...
But, no, yeah, but, they put him in places where it's like, hey, look at this person. Hey. You see?
We got to play the president now.
Yeah, let's see. We had Niecy Nash playing a small part. We had Cuba Gooding Jr., an Oscar winner, playing a small part. We have Martin Sheen, an icon in his own right, playing a small part. Very small parts, not very not grandiose, with the exception, I guess, of Martin Sheen. But let's be honest, you put Martin Sheen in a movie, he's gonna show out. I mean, there's very little that he could do to hide. He's just that big, and we might hopefully get to talk about him some more this year. But it's just that there's so many actors, and I'm just barely touching the barrel. I mean, you know, we have Dylan Baker, you know, Doc Ock, taking a various
Dr. Connors from.
Although let's be honest here, J. Edgar Hoover is easily a bigger villain than Doc Ock ever was.
Yeah, or, you know, not Doc Ock.
Kirk Connors. Sorry, not,
yeah,
not
he
Doc
was supposed
Ock.
To play the lizard. Lizard got recast by a British guy. Come on. the J. Edgar Hoover bit.
I'm starting to think that Trump should be banning Brits because they keep taking all our jobs.
Yeah. Well, that's been the case for a while, including Alan Rickman, who played Ronald Reagan in the book.
Yeah. I'm trying to forget that. I'm sorry. That was the last thing I saw Alan Rickman in before his unfortunate passing, and I am trying my hardest to forget that I saw that because I don't want – that is like the most shameful final film. I mean, that wasn't even his final film. He actually did other works, but – I don't want to remember him like that. That was so painful watching him as Ronald Reagan.
But the point with the cast of this film is, and again, when you have stories that have massive amounts of very well-known individuals, then it can get a little daunting to try to cast. And it certainly, I mean, how do you cast a Lyndon Johnson? That's a challenge for both films to try to do, like the Butler, I think, went with Liv Schreiber. And
although I have to admit, though, I mean, age of McConaughey, and I feel like he could. I mean, he would have definitely over. He would have played a little bit outward, but considering the new McConaughey, I feel like to see him take on such a flamboyant Texan and to be able to try to match that with you know, where strength that the film required.
Well, the audition reel has to be that recording of Lyndon Johnson ordering pants on the telephone and talking about, you know, how they need to not be so tight and, you know.
Well, you know how Bryan Cranston won his Tony for playing Johnson in All the Way? I feel like we should have, like, McConaughey do a Broadway of playing Johnson, but play the parts of the parts that weren't in All the Way, kind of like the blooper reel. I feel like he could get his Tony on that as well. So just saying. You know, the conversations with the astronauts and the ordering McNamara around should be fun. Which is interesting. Dylan Baker actually played McNamara in another film. I think at some point Dylan Baker's played at least a part of every part of Kennedy and Johnson's cabinet without actually playing Kennedy or Johnson.
I want to say he was also on the TV show Kings. Which makes it even more meta when you consider this film.
We're getting there. Definitely getting there.
Do we want to quick do the geek sheet and then our
the geek sheet is deeper than you can ever imagine.
I mean, with a cast this big and it's so many it's so many people. Like, was it bad of me when Lorraine Toussaint's character was getting hit over the head? That I was still kind of glad because I think of her as V from Orange is the New Black. And I'm like, yeah, Yeah.
Seriously.
I still haven't seen season three.
I haven't seen season two yet.
Oh,
yeah,
I think she's in season two, right?
Yeah, she's at V is yeah. season two.
Season two. So, I mean, it gets a little hard with certain character actors, especially when you only see them in a scene or two and you don't really get a sense of them as their own character in the setting. Like Giovanni Ribisi, mm-hmm. I'm like, well, yeah, he's just playing kind of like Giovanni Ribisi. I don't really see what, you know, who exactly he is in this film. It's just, okay, fine.
Well, rocking the bald head, though.
Yeah, right, right.
But, I mean, again, so let's see here. We have how many Marvel are Marvel actors here? It's like, I want to say like at least 10 or at least 10, right?
Wow.
I mean, you know, let's see. Oh, David Oyelowo, we didn't mention that he's Agent Kallus in Star Wars Rebels.
Yep.
Which is interesting. I mean, David Oyelowo playing a white guy.
Yeah, and I didn't know. Yeah. So I looked at it, it's like, he's Kallus?
He was also the guy
with bad sideburns, too.
And speaking of which, he was also the guy that told Matthew McConaughey his daughter ain't good enough that she should just be a farmer, so that, you know, he can give his impassioned speech.
His best credit, though, has to come from Robot Chicken. I'm looking at his IMDb page.
Yeah.
He was in an episode of Robot Chicken. He played Sebastian in the episode Walking Dead Lobster, which I just have to really appreciate.
That's true. Although I'm going to throw out a shout out to a frequent listener of ours, Cody, who is a huge MI5 fan. I'm pretty sure that he would be amiss if I didn't mention that he was a part of MI5, a character who had a regular – he was actually a regular of sorts, yeah. Although he didn't get a whole lot of credit for that. For me, I don't know. I mean, he's an actor that I've been paying attention to for a while. I'm glad that he is starting to think. Although he did an interesting film this year called Captive, which was one of those Christian Christian films, which he also produced. So I'm curious to see if he's going to be possibly elevating the game on some Christian films. I would actually like to see some good Christian films come out. So yeah.
This one kind of is. I mean, certainly if you talk about what the true Christian message is, not the kind of way that Christianity gets co-opted in a lot of times, this film Selma does truly fit in that mindset, or in that philosophy of, you know, what that means.
So
let's not forget that we had an actual president in this film, Jed Bartlett. Appear.
That's not Jed Bartlett. That's Uncle Ben.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So he can't be both.
He's Willard. I mean, for crying out loud. I mean, you know, Apocalypse Now, possibly one of the greatest films of all time. You can't ignore him on that. But yeah, I mean, for me, it's the weirdest one is seeing Niecy Nash, because I still remember her in Reno 911. I'm sorry. And Wendell Pierce. I can't believe I forgot to mention Wendell Pierce, one of my all-time favorite actors. And yes, I'm sorry. I love Wendell Pierce. He actually has some awesome moments in this film. He was so good. I actually put him in the cast list for this film, and I can't believe that I completely forgot to mention him. I mean, you know, he was the one who took the lead on the march on the bridge. You know, the one that got attacked. I mean, right. He was the one who got the short straw, right? You know, had to get out in front had to lead them over the bridge. By the way, before we go, can we talk about the bridge right quick? Because they actually shot on the on the bridge.
Yeah. I think this is kind of like the one of the iconic scenes in the film, and you actually get three takes on the bridge. There's take one, which ends in the beating. You get take two, which is led by King, but then aborted. And then you get the final triumphant take, all the way to Montgomery.
And then, of course, you have the music video for Glory, which also took place on...
Right, and then the Oscars portrayal, reinterpretation of it on stage. But yeah, I mean, certainly you couldn't shoot it anywhere else, right? I mean, and you couldn't kind of make that, you know, you'd have to make the entire bridge on a soundstage or on a backlot or something would be pretty impressive. But the fact that they filmed it there and you know, I kind of wonder about the days that they filmed there in Selma, what that was like for some of the residents, maybe some that had lived through the actual events. You know, there's probably a cool behind the scenes featurette there somewhere, but
that's true. Yeah. All right, so at this point, by the way, to let you know, Carmen Njogo, who we've talked about with play Cry Scott King, she's actually going to be in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them with a one Academy Award winning actor, Eddie Redmayne, which I found quite interesting. Just say, you know, a future geek cheater, so to say.
Right.
All right. So are y'all ready to call it?
Let's call it.
Yeah.
Okay. Kent, Lobster, do you agree with the critics on Selma? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Lobster.
Yeah. So this is a really, really well-made film. And it's kind of sad for me to look at it now and talk about it. Knowing that it didn't win an Oscar last year. And again, I think last year was a really close year with a lot of films that really got recognition. And we had a split ticket, I believe, between the director and the film that ultimately won last year, right?
Well, the director was Birdman, and
Okay, yeah. I'm sorry. I'm thinking of the year before it was a split ticket. But again, I mean that was an Oscar race that could have gone a lot of different ways. And I think in particular when we're talking about the Oscars this year, a lot of the narrative about the ceremony itself has been that for the second year in a row there have been no African American or Black actors nominated. And I think that is certainly something that I know that the Academy is taking steps to remedy in they're kind of revising how they elect their voting members and kind of like who gets a vote. But also, I think industry wide is something that certainly the industry really needs to come to terms with. And I think the way that you do that is by encouraging filmmakers like Ava DuVernay and films like Selma that not only showcase very strong performances by actors of color, but also contain a message that is one of hope. And you can kind of contrast that with how we assessed 12 Years a Slave last year. Which again, another Oscar-winning film, and certainly one that rightfully showcased some very strong performances, and ultimately this the end of this message, and certainly the message of the song Glory is one of hope, and one of encouraging, continuing to strive for change and to push for equality and the glory that kind of can come as a result of that when we're all uplifted by helping uplift those who have been oppressed. And so I have to give this film a pass, not only on kind of the technical merits of the film and the performances, but certainly on recognizing that it perhaps deserves more acclaim than it received, and it's something like 99% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. So I know the critics have certainly praised this film, but I can only hope to add to that by giving it a pass.
Kent,
I'm giving it a pass, but mostly for content and just how it's presented. I almost want to say this should be mandatory viewing in history classes. You know, just for the oh, we're just going to watch a movie today instead of actually looking at the textbook. Here's the civil rights movement. This is where this is just one little aspect of it. This is a small corner of the bigger picture, and it just encapsulates all of, you know, when people go, well, it was great back in the good old days. It's like, look at this. Tell me it was good. Well, this is fictionalized. It's, if this is badly fictionalized, but people will say, yeah, this is exactly how it was, then that's not what you want to go back to. And you can make the argument that, oh yeah, things are better now, but in some ways did the exact same way. I'm sure back then when they were doing the cavalry charge onto the bridge to knock people walking over, somebody was spinning it like, oh, did you see that guy who we knocked down on the horse? Oh, well, he swung his arm, so he was assaulting us. The same thing going on today with, oh, that guy, yeah, we beat him up because he resisted arrest. Well, what was he being arrested for? Well, yeah, forget that. We say it. So, kind of rambling there, but I think you get the point that it's like, there's a very, very good speech in here where the guy, where after the bridge scene, the guy goes, one of the guys goes, I need a gun. I'm going to go back and shoot him. And he gets talked down, which I don't know if that was written specifically for this. It may be based on original, on what originally happened. I kind of get the impression it was written for today. Just kind of saying, yes, they have more guns. They have more than you do, and they'll kill a bunch of us if you kill one of them. Which is a sad message, but at the same time, good. So it's almost a necessity, this movie, which is rare.
I agree.
Yeah.
And I think one thing I noticed with the film was that they actually slip in two F words, which is surprising for a PG-13 film.
And You're allowed one.
I know you're allowed one, but to have two in there, I was like, oh, they let that slip in.
That's what
one thing for our listeners, I really heartily recommend, and this documentary has been around for years, but Eyes on the Prize, which is, I believe, like a 10-part PBS documentary series that takes a look at the civil rights movement, and specifically they have an entire episode devoted to Selma, which is pretty great. If you're interested in kind of like seeing that portrayed in kind of a documentary style, is really fantastic. So, but definitely required viewing, I think, for any social studies class. I certainly would show it in one of mine.
All right, so you know, this is my second time seeing it. I was deeply a fan of it the first time. This time around, I have to say that I admire this film for other things along with what I initially admired it for in my first take on it. Again, the use of shadow, the use of lighting, being able to tell not just Martin Luther King's story, but specifically Coretta Scott King's story as well, which is, especially this time around, came off a lot more prominent, prevalent, and important, considering all the things that she had to go through, and she didn't get nearly as much appreciation as Martin Luther King did. The film, when it comes to the Oscar race last year, I was adamant. Y'all remember my conversation about this. David Oyelowo was robbed of a nomination. I still feel vehemently about that. His performance was incredible. In considering, again, playing such an important figure and not playing him like we would normally expect a prominent figure to be played, Ava DuVernay could have easily taken Clint Eastwood's spot. I'm sorry, American Sniper had no right to be anywhere in that roster, in my opinion. So in that case, I would agree that that this film probably deserved a lot more than it got. Although in other cases, I probably wouldn't have put it up there with other places. Specifically, in the writing section, the writing was a little drawn out. The way that the film came off, a lot of it was Ava DuVernay. Ava DuVernay specifically showed that she had not just the capability of making a great film, but she was capable of making a film that tied elements together in a way that was both vital for the moment as well as for being respectful to the subject matter that it was dealing with. She wasn't telling a message film in the sense of that this is something important today, while at the same time she also didn't feel like she was tied down to the points of history to the point where she couldn't tell a story that she wanted to tell. I can't wait to see what she does in her career. I feel like there's a lot more to expect. And who knows? She might actually win an Oscar on a later film. I would love to see that specifically because I think that she has it in her. Of course, I could be wrong, but I don't think so in this instance. And I'm glad that she didn't get the Marvel gig, to be honest. Just because I think that she has a voice that I want to see her voice. I don't want to see her doing other people's voices. I want to see her voice.
Yeah, kind of the Marvel thing to me is I think that if you're a very strong-willed director, they're not interested in having you if you want to bring your own spin on it. And I point to, like, for instance, Edgar Wright, who backed out of doing a Marvel film that he had been attached to for a long time because that might not be the best platform for self-expression.
I think that, I mean, there are other directors that can definitely get their stamp on it, but sure. She is a young filmmaker and one that has
nothing
extraordinary
but good stuff
promises
ahead of her.
Yeah, again, she could fail. I mean, it's not guaranteed that she's going to make an Oscar film later on. I think that she has it in her, and I would love to see her. I can't wait to see what she does next, specifically. David Oyelowo has, in my opinion, shown that he's capable of doing anything, and I would love to see him continue down this path. While I hope he does also pursue the other things he's doing, especially these Christian movies, who knows? Maybe they actually will turn out to lead him down other interesting paths. How I feel about the film and relations to the current time, I think that there are things that tie this that need to be said in the current time in regards to what Selma is trying to say. I also believe that that Selma, rightfully so, keeps the subject in Selma and keeps it in these events because I don't think that the civil rights movement has gotten it has either been romanticized or it's been turned into horror. I don't think that we have a truly comprehensive take on the civil rights, and I think that this is one step closer to it. That said, I think this film is great. I strongly recommend it. This is definitely a pass for me. Give it a shot, and who knows? Maybe this will garner. This will become a film that just like Shawshank Redemption it went up against Titans and it became a classic in its own right.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, I don't want to take away from those other films because those other films were good, with the exception of American Sniper, like I said, but. Everything else.
It knows what it did. It can go sit in the corner now.
I'm not going in there. No, we're not doing that for Art House Rejects because it unfortunately got way too many acclaims. But that said, Selma, strong pass.
Yeah.
Watch it. A great start to what I think is going to be an exciting Oscar season over here at Art House of Legends. We have four films. That is definitely a lot more diverse than what I could say for the current Academy.
Current slate, yeah.
Now, I will actually address the Oscar issue on a vidcast on YouTube probably in the next week or so if you want to check that out. But I will say that for us, our next step is to Ireland.
It is, yeah.
You know, for a little great music and possibly even some very unique backgrounds and origins.
We're going to do a romance film, which I think has been long in the running for us to do, a really, really romantic movie. Yes. And it's going to be fun. We're sticking with a best song winner once, Falling Slowly. But I think there's going to be more to it than that. So this is what I'm excited to watch.
And then afterwards, we're going to actually get into a Best Actor winner this time around. We're heading over to the mean streets of Los Angeles in 2001, where a seasoned professional police officer, played by Denzel Washington, is giving a rookie a run for his money in training day. I am actually quite excited.
Get our training wheels on for that one, because I don't know if I'm ready for a two-wheeler yet.
Then we're going to end things up with an Italian film. Finally, we're getting to Italy. Although it's set in China? What?
Why not? International.
All right, but
they did do spaghetti westerns, so it's not that much of a stretch, I guess.
But still China. Okay. But yes, we're doing the 1988 Best Picture winner, The Last Emperor, which I know a few people that are actually quite excited for that one, and I am too. So, yes, it's going to be exciting. But that is our February roster. Please join us, because this is going to be an incredible Oscar season for us. And if you have your opinions on this film or any of the other films we're doing, hit us up on our Twitter feed at Art House Legends, as well as you can send us an email at arthouselegends@gmail.com. And, of course, like I said, I'm doing some videos over on the Art House Legends vidcast on YouTube. Check those out as well. I'm actually getting a lot of stuff together. I'm going to be pushing them out pretty quickly, time bearing. But, again, join us for all of this. It's going to be awesome. Thank you, fellas, for joining me for this amazing discussion. And any last words?
Glory.
Ken?
Remember to cross that bridge when you get to it. I don't know.
All right. This is the Movie Dude Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is John O'Lobster.
And Fiend.
Thank you for listening. If you want to leave us feedback, go to GunnaGeek.com and you will find all of our contact information and other shows. The music heard on this podcast is by Kevin MacLeod and can be found at Incompetech.com. The opinions heard on this podcast are those of the individual host and do not represent Legend Stream Canada or Gunna Geek. No infringement is intended.